tonight on Arena. Andrew Bennett on his staged performance of Claire Keegan's Small Things Like These and the ups and downs of today's Golden Globe nominations. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. The European Film Awards took place in Switzerland over the weekend. Now in their 37th year, this is the last time the ceremony will be held in December, with plans to move to a more awards season-y slot in January, happening for the next edition of the ceremony in 2026. In other years, this has been a great show for the Irish film industry. More of that anon. Tara Brady was in Switzerland at the weekend. She's with me in studio now. And before we get to those European Film Awards, Tara, can we briefly mention the Golden Globe nominations this afternoon? A good day for the Irish, I am saying out loud.
I entirely agree. I think it is a good day for the Irish. I think it's a great day for Andrew Scott and it's a great day for Colin Farrell. And it's really interesting that there are two supervillains facing off against each other at the Golden Globes. But I think that's fantastic. I think we've become very, very spoiled. And I thought it was very interesting in the run up to the European Film Awards that people were going, only two nominations. And it was, and it, again, it's very interesting that all of the headlines are, but where is Saoirse? But where is... It's like, well, yeah, you know, this is... We're two nominations is still, for a country of our population size and for, you know, an industry our size, punching above our weight. Thank you very much.
The headline on the Irish Times Online was a bad day for the Irish at the Golden Globes.
I know. There is a degree of wailing and gnashing of teeth definitely going on, like across the media, I think, in Ireland. Yeah. There's a lot of as well, sort of, well, where's Paul Mescal? It's like, well, what was he going to get nominated for? Gladiator's not an acting driven movie. It's a CGI shark driven movie. That's what it is.
Let's talk about the two nominations. Andrew Scott for Ripley and Colin Farrell for Penguin. I mean, it's very difficult to work out who's going to. They're both brilliant performances.
I know. It is sort of who's the most evil character. They are both very good. It's good. I think it is going to be an absolute toss of the coin. And you would have to say.
And you think it's between the two of them?
The one thing I would worry about is, are they going to split the vote? I mean, it's a very competitive category.
Can there be a coalition?
can we gerrymander it in an Irish kind of way? Yeah, that would be. But I don't. It will be very interesting. I think it'll. I mean, like a lot of campaigns, I think it'll ultimately come down to who runs the best campaign and who has the most money and which studio is willing to put a little bit of push behind it.
All right. I happen to have a clip of Colin Farrell. That is not that I am saying that he is more likely to win than Andrew Scott. I might ask you afterwards, Tara, to point your colours to the mast. Let's have a listen to Colin Farrell in a scene from The Penguin quite early on. This is the point at which the son of the previous big lord that The Penguin has worked for has just died. And this is the conversation between the two of them. Little bit of language in the midst of this clip.
I see you've made yourself at home.
Hey, Alberto, you're here. Good. Saves me a trip.
What the fuck are you talking about?
These jewels belong to you. Your dad made that clear. But some of the guys, well, you know, they're goddamn scavengers. So I thought I'd do you a solid. As a show of support for your new position. Well, congratulations. I only wish it had been under different circumstances. Carmine. He was a great man. You got some big shoes to fill. not too big. I mean, you know, manageable shoes.
You think I'm an idiot? You greedy prick? My father's been dead a week.
Hey, Al. You all right? Because we keep a stash in the loft if you want a hit.
That's not why I'm here.
Of course not. I mean, I was only saying.
You don't get it. Everyone's looking at me now. I got this deal going.
There we go, Colin Farrell in a scene from The Penguin. One of the two Irish nominations for Best Actor at the Golden Globes today, in a television series that is, Colin Farrell in The Penguin, Andrew Scott in Ripley. Would you care to choose between the two of them, Tara?
Oh gosh, it would be very difficult. If I had to pin my colours to the mast, I'd say Colin. I do think there's a lot going on in that performance. So.
Yeah, and mind you, having said all of that, here we are presuming that we are going to be one of the winners.
Indeed,
an incredibly competitive category.
It's a usually competitive, and if you think about it, like Richard Gadd nominated for Baby Reindeer. Baby Reindeer was not The Penguin. It was not a show that was on the side of buses. It was not a show that had billboards. It was pure word of mouth, and like everybody you met was watching it or was about to watch it, and it just had that real kind of grassroots popularity to it that you can't pay for.
Kevin Kline in Disclaimer, Cooper Koch, Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story. He was Lyle, I think, was the brother that he played.
Oh, you ask a good question.
I'm pretty certain it was. Yeah. I've been told it was. I'm pretty certain.
But that's a fiercely competitive category, and you know, Ewan McGregor as well.
Yeah.
It's a very starry category, you'd have to say. These are all people that you expect to see at movie award ceremonies rather than, you know, just television ones. So it's a big deal. Kevin Kline is really, really interesting performance in Disclaimer because it's one of those shows where you think everybody's doing something, but they're actually doing something else, and he really rolls with that because sometimes he's very, very comical in the way that he and he has great comic chops, and then he's very, very sinister.
Disclaimer from me right now. In fact, Cooper Koch was Eric Menendez.
Okay, well, there we go.
Well, he was the other brother. He was one of the brothers. We know that for sure. Are we disappointed about Kneecap, nominated in two categories, but no joy in either?
At the European Film Awards.
I've jumped there, yeah.
Yes. My golly, it was a really, really competitive year. And the European Film Awards are very, very good at awarding like craft, you know, particularly things that are very striking, like the production design in Girl with a Needle, things like that. So they are fairly well spread. If you remember a few years ago, and Colleen Kuehn won for cinematography. So
we'll be talking to Andrew Bennett in a little bit later on this evening.
Oh wow, there you go. But so we have we're making links all over the place. But I think there were some very interesting choices there. It's very competitive. European cinema has never been better. I mean, that's the real story here is that Europeans, if you remember years ago, people going, the Irish are coming or British are coming, really the Europeans are coming. And you can see that the kind of, there's now a huge relationship between Venice, Cannes, European Film Awards, and then the American ceremonies. And you could see that last year, even last year when you had two big populist movies going toe to toe, Barbie and Oppenheimer at the Oscars, more like over the half of the categories were films that had premiered at Cannes and Venice and won prizes at Cannes. Venice.
Yes, I've noticed you have a new term, which is Oscarologist.
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 Yes, yes, there are people who describe themselves. I even know one of them, unfortunately. So
Oscarologists, what they are saying, that if you don't get to Cannes and Venice, that's the marker.
That definitely seems to be the pattern. And this is a new thing, because if you remember years ago, the wisdom was, if you don't open your film in December, and then we'd end up with this ridiculous, it won't be up for Oscars. And then we ended up with this ridiculous glut of really good films in January and February when people weren't necessarily going to the cinema. But what happened then, the real turning point was Parasite. Parasite like won at Cannes and then went on to win Best Picture. And since then you see that. And I think there's a really interesting thing if you look at the nominations for Best Director in the Golden Globes. Every single one of them are Venice or Cannes titles.
And what about sticking a little bit with the Golden Globes for a moment then, Saoirse Ronan not there for either The Outrun or Blitz.
Well, it's interesting. The same kind of logic applies. If you notice, like the spot that people thought maybe she had a chance with most likely went to Nicole Kidman for Baby Girl, which we would have talked about on this show at Venice. And again, that does seem to be the thing that's making a difference, and it's making the difference across a whole range of categories. categories. And the if you go through the female acting list, that's very evident, because it's Carla Sofia Gazan, who became the first trans woman to win the European Actress Award at the European Film Awards at the weekend, in a big sweep for Emilia Perez. Again, like, it won awards at Cannes, and again, you're seeing it there, and it leads the field at the Golden Globes with nominations.
Yeah, let's have a listen to Carla Sofia Gazan at the European Film Awards. This is her acceptance. She mentioned Jacques in the midst of this, which is, she's referring to ODR. Jacques Audiard.
I want to say thank you first. Merci beaucoup. Grazie mille. Danke schön. Gracias. Al mejor director europeo, at the best director, European director, for making the best European actress. Thank you, Jack. Thank you. This is yours.
There's Carla Sofia Gazan accepting her award for Best Actress at the European Film Awards that Tara Brady was present. A beautiful blue dress, I believe,
wore it to represent the European flag, but said she couldn't find any stars. So
there you go.
But she's star enough in the dress.
Yeah, but I want to listen to a little bit, because this was an extraordinary piece of work, this ODR, because it moves from kind of high drama into musical. It kind of flips over into itself without my... Certainly when I started watching it, I wasn't expecting it to do that.
It's really interesting, because it's pitched at the level of telenovela. I mean, and ODR is a very interesting director, because you never know from film to film what you're going to get with him. Because if you compare it to something like A Prophet, there's absolutely... know, that you'd never imagine that they came from the same director. But it is a very odd beast, Emilia Perez, because it has the whole narco thing going. It has a very, very telenovela soap, family soap opera thing going on. I mean, the premise is lifted directly from that kind of very high Latina telenovela. This idea that someone would go off, get a sex change, and then smuggle their family back in and pretend to be somebody else. I mean, it's an incredibly melodramatic conceit, but the tone is consistent, and it gets away with
and
it.
And Zoe Saldana is the lawyer who assists in all of this, in all of this action. And here she is. This is from the very beginning, actually, of the film, I think, where she's walking along the street trying to work out, how am I going to approach this case? Esther Castle. This case. What am I going to do? How am I going to argue it? And the whole village starts walking behind her, and they all break into song.
Este caso. Señor presidente, señor juez, honorables defensores de la familia de la difunta, honorables colegas de la parte civil, estimados miembros del jurado, estoy de acuerdo con mis colegas de la fiscalía. Este caso es un caso demasiado mundano, es un caso de violencia. Ir hacia arriba, ir hacia abajo, ir hacia arriba. ¿De qué hablamos hoy y ahora?
¿De qué hablamos?
Hablamos de violencia.
Hablamos de violencia,
de amor, de muerte,
de amor,
de un país que sufre. ¿De quién hablamos hoy y ahora?
¿De qué hablamos?
Hablamos de una pareja. La pareja que formaba mi cliente con su esposa, a quien no pudo evitar que se quitara la vida.
There we are, Zoe Saldana. As I said, the whole village goes in behind her.
It is one of the very few musicals where, like, them all bursting into song is one of the more plausible things that's going on.
Emilia
in the film.
Perez is what we're speaking about, one of the big winners at the European Film Awards. I mentioned Tara at the beginning about Kneecap. So, how did they do here, first of all, in terms of the European Film Awards?
So they were nominated for two European. One is the Fipresi Prize, which is a critics decided prize, and the other one is the University Prize, which is really interesting because it's decided by different university students from 21 different universities across Europe. But in the end, they lost both of those out. But they did lose to very, very good films. Again, it comes down to this idea that it's a very tough category. They lost to Armand, which is a really you'll really like it. It's a parent that comes into a parent-teacher meeting, and it's all set in the parent-teacher meeting. It's absolutely one of the most nervy thrillers that you could see, and it is directed by Ingmar Bergman's grandson.
Oh, there you go.
So
If you're going to lose, lose well. Well,
this is
the point where we're talking about those who have lost out. It's not that they've lost out. Better works have won, so we should remember. But there are no nominations for NECAP in the Golden Globes.
No.
And what are your Oscarologists' friends saying about that?
There's still a chance for them to get in, because bear in mind, if you remember, Anne Colleen-Kuhn did not get into the foreign language category at the Golden Globes either. So there is still a pathway to it. However, there are a lot of really, really good films, and it's very interesting because there's a lot of really, really good films up that will be in the foreign category that are already competing in other categories. Like, for example, All We Imagine Is Light is up for Best Director in the Golden Globes. It's a very good chance to get into the film list as well. So Amelia Perez is another one, and it has France behind it. So you have to think that it's going to be, again, a fiercely competitive category. They might be a bit sorry that they've missed out on Song as well, which people thought they might have had a chance at, but that didn't happen.
You are keen to mention the number of comebacks that seem to be present in the European Film Awards.
Yes, at the Golden Globe. The Golden Globes, I think, is kind of the big comeback award ceremony, I think, this year. The first thing we have is, of course, Angelina Jolie and her return to acting, because in recent years she's just become completely she's far more associated with, you know, whatever is going on in her domestic dramas, or not going on, just people say is going on. But she's come back to play Maria Callas. She is the current favourite in the Oscar race. Even though the Oscars haven't been announced yet, And she is up for a Golden Globe. But the other two comebacks, of course, are Demi Moore, who we've talked about before. We've talked about her here for The Substance. It's an absolutely great role for her. It has so much to say about how actresses are treated by Hollywood and by show business generally. And it's a really fun part with, you know, what's lots of splatter. But the other comeback that I think is really worth mentioning is Pamela Anderson, an all-around good sport, has been for years, campaigned for years to get for the release of Julian Assange, campaigned for animal rights. It seems to be always a decent old sort. But yet, as for many years, people, you'd say Pamela Anderson, everyone goes Baywatch. That's it. So finally, she has a role that could get her out of the Baywatch ghetto. She has a Golden Globe nominated role in The Last Showgirl.
Well, there you go. And nobody who's going to interview her about that is going to ask her about Baywatch. Is that what you think?
I don't think that's it, but I did really enjoy Liam Neeson declaring absolute love for her and her performance. That was very enjoyable recently.
Yeah, well, there you go. All right. I'm sure this shall all come out. We'll see it all come out in the wash in January when we get the Oscars and when things start to kick in that particular neck of the woods. Will we give NECAP a Better Way to Live an Owl's Spin, given that they didn't get their nomination for Song?
I think that they're waiting for that as a kind of compensation.
Within the Oscars?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's give them a spin right now.
I know it exists, but I can't stop getting one more thing, I'll be added to the list.
There you go. They may not have got the Golden Globe nomination, but who said? Tara Brady seems to think they'd be in with a shout when it comes to Oscar nominations and Best Song for NECAP. Better Way to Live, the Graeme Chatten, voice of Graeme Chatten being heard within that. And we look forward to seeing and hearing how many Irish nominations we will have for this year's Oscars when the time comes. In October, there were yellow trees. So begin small things like these. Claire Keegan's story of Bill Furlong, a coal and timber merchant living in an Irish town and deeply disturbed by the goings-on in the local convent in the weeks running up to Christmas 1985. It was, of course, also released this year as a film starring Cillian Murphy. And only last week, there were pictures on social media of Claire Keegan meeting Oprah Winfrey, as Small Things Like These was selected for Oprah's latest book club. Next week, Andrew Bennett, no pressure then on that one, Andrew, gives a staged reading of the book accompanied by live original music from Eleanor McAvoy at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. And I'm delighted that Andrew is with me in studio this evening. Of course, your connection, we were talking about you just 10 minutes ago, Andrew. Oh, your connection to Claire Keegan goes back to On Colleen Kuhn, which was an Irish language version, kind of loosely based on Foster, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know how loosely based. Mm. The fact that it was in a different language obviously let us away with an awful lot. But I wouldn't say exactly loosely based. I think it's fairly true to it.
Did you go to the English language novel when you were doing On Colleen Kuhn to kind of get to get in behind? Sean Kinsella was the character, wasn't he?
I hadn't read the novel, and I'd read her other stuff, her short stories from years ago. And so when I was auditioning for it, I read it in English, obviously, because there isn't an Irish language version of it, I don't think.
Yes, yeah. And then how did it go about? There's a story about you going for the audition for On Colleen Kuhn, isn't there?
Well, it was during COVID time, so it was very... It was like the 1980s, like there was grass on Grafton Street, and I remember for the callback cycling out to Island Bridge and everybody there speaking Irish as if English didn't exist, and I was very out of my depth really there. But is that the one you meant?
Yeah, no, that's exactly the one I meant. The fact that the place was deserted.
Oh, totally deserted. No cars.
That role and that particular piece, it has such a tone of it. This wonderful facility that Claire Keegan has to say huge amounts with very little.
Amazing.
Do you find the same thing when it comes to the reading of Small Things Like These?
Totally. I mean, the book, you could read it in your own head in an hour. I mean, we take about like under 2 hours with the stage reading, but that's with music and, you know, allowing the thing to sit. But there are no loose words. I mean, it's probably the book I know best in the world because I've read it so often, and there are just no loose words in it. She redoes and redrafts endlessly, and you can really feel it in the tightness of the language. It's absolutely brilliant. It's nearly like a poem.
And how, I was going to ask you that, how performative is it? How much does it lift off the page into a performance?
Well, it's a funny thing because you can't perform it too much. Like when you're reading, like, who are you playing? Like, you're not, are you playing Claire Keegan? Patently not. So you're this kind of ghost figure who has to give the whole book to the audience. You know, that's what they've come for. But if you perform it too much, then you get between the audience and the book. You're distracting, you know, by doing voices and whatever. So every night, that's the problem every night, trying to get that balance right of being fully there, giving the full, beautiful story and not getting just too much in the way.
Staying out of the way of the brilliance of the of the prose. You're going to read, we'll hear a couple of sections, in fact, but the one that you're going to start with, we're kind of quite early on in the novel here, really, aren't we?
Yeah, it's the novel is in 7 kind of chapters, and this is the start of chapter 3. The first chapter is really, really short, the second one shortish, and this is the start of the third chapter, so it's towards the beginning of the book.
And this very much sets up the time of year
and
what's happening.
Christmas was coming. Already a handsome Norway spruce was put standing in the square beside the manger, whose nativity figures that year had been freshly painted. If some complained over Joseph looking overly colourful in his red and purple robes, the Virgin Mary was met with general approval, kneeling passively in her usual blue and white. The brown donkey, too, looked much the same, standing guard over 2 sleeping ewes and the crib, where, on Christmas Eve, the figure of the infant Jesus would be placed. The custom was for people to gather there on the first Sunday of December, outside the town hall, after dark, to see the lights coming on. The afternoon stayed dry, but the cold was bitter, and Eileen made the girls zip up their anoraks and wear gloves. When they reached the centre of town, the pipe band and carol singers had already assembled, and Mrs. Keogh was out with a stall selling slabs of gingerbread and hot chocolate. Joan, who had gone on ahead, was handing out carol sheets with other members of the choir, while the nuns walked around, supervising and talking to some of the more well-off parents.
Andrew Bennett there reading from Small Things Like These, Clare Keegan's novel, which he's giving a staged reading of at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. And the music that we heard there, Andrew, as you were setting out, because it really does evoke a sense of Christmas, doesn't
totally,
it?
Totally.
It's Eleanor McAvoy's music.
She's an amazingly talented individual. She wrote all the music herself. She performs it live with me on stage every night, and she plays an array of instruments, like a keyboard, several different guitars, a fiddle. Like, it's amazing. It really lifts the piece, you know.
And I'm guessing the fact that she's performing live, that allows for a certain amount of breathing that, you know, when you're playing against a backing track like you are there,
yeah,
you're kind of hooked in. You can't change it.
No, Eleanor is totally into the piece. She's following exactly. If I mess up, she knows exactly how to cover. And she can just feel the thing, and she knows like what volume to come in at, and she's brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant.
So you have the music aspect of it, your reading of the novel in its entirety, as you say. And what about lighting and kind of stage effects? How do you play with that, or do you play with it at all?
It's very slight. There are little movements, like between each chapter, there's slight changing of chairs and things, a little bit of Christmas lighting and slight, very, very small, but enough to like let an audience, if you just keep reading at people, they're going to go, oh God, when is this going to be over? Whereas you just give them a little break to scratch their noses. And
yet, as you said about if you start overacting the words itself, if you did too much with it, it's a very delicate piece.
Yeah. It's you just can't. You can't. Like, there are bits where they say such a one has a very strong Enniscorthy accent, and we toyed with that, but it sounded all kind of wrong for me doing. I'm not very good at doing accents anyway, but it just does sound a bit too sort of, look at me, I'm able to do accents.
Yeah, and I suppose when it says such and such a character has a strong Enniscorthy accent,
it's not needed.
It said it.
It's not needed.
It's told you it.
Yeah.
It's told you it. The Sean Kinsella character in On Colleen Kuhn and Bill Furlong here in Small Things Like These, these are good men. These are quiet men. Yeah. It's very interesting the type of man that Clare Keegan writes.
Yeah, they're very, very similar. You know, they're both, as you say, quiet, serious, contemplative sort of men. Both of whom work. They're both labourers. One's a farmer, one's a coal merchant. And they both have these terrible sadnesses in their past. But the sadnesses haven't hardened them. The opposite of anything. They both are very empathetic and recognise other people's sadnesses and do things about other people's sadnesses, you know.
And as you say, it's not that you're playing Bill Furlong in this. You're playing the omniscient narrator,
exactly,
who kind of sees and knows everything that's happening in the past and in the present.
Yeah.
But did you find yourself kind of associating to Bill Furlong in a way that, given that, you know, you could play the part?
Not when I'm reading it, I don't, but like the sheer like strength of the novel, you sometimes, it's a slight problem sometimes that you can get carried away and you can get too emotional, which that clogs your voice and you can't deliver the piece properly. And especially some of Eleanor's music is really heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
And so you just have to be very careful with that. But yeah, he's an amazing, beautiful, they're both these beautiful men that Clare has created. Yeah,
I suppose you're touching on the old thing. There's no point in you crying.
Yeah.
It's the audience that you want to be crying or laughing.
Yeah, exactly.
As the case may be. Have you seen the film version?
I haven't yet. And
are you avoiding it? Or
no? Well, then Eleanor accused me of that as well. She asked me to go and see it because she could only go and see it once, she's on tour at the moment.
Right.
And I just wasn't available. And she said, oh, for artistic reasons. And I said, no, not for artistic reasons. I just couldn't. And I just haven't got around. But I will, definitely. I've heard brilliant things about it.
Yeah, and I suppose Cillian Murphy in that role of Bill Furlong, be interested to see what he has
done. Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
The book ends, I don't want to be given too much away for those who haven't read the book, but as you say, you could certainly knock it down in an evening if you sat down and did it in your own head. Have you ideas or opinions about what happens after the book? He's taking this girl from a local convent, and we're wondering what's going to happen beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, I was alive in the 19. I think it's set in 1985. Well, it's definitely set in 1985.
Yeah,
and I believe the police would have gotten involved. I don't think you could do that. I don't think you could just go to a convent, a Magdalen Laundry, and take a child out of it. But like, the book ends really positively. It's a beautiful ending.
Yeah.
But then in the cold light of day, you go, but sure, what happens after that?
But there's something about that similar in Colleen Kuhn and Foster. Because even though there's a sadness at the end of Colleen Kuhn, there's that wonderful moment between the little girl and your character of Sean Kinsella, similarly uplifting.
And the other thing about at the end of Foster, you know, you go, but she can come back next summer and the summer after. Whereas this book is, I mean, it's funny because Foster is really it's like the classic Irish summer book.
Yeah.
And this is absolutely
the classic
winter.
Christmas and winter book.
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah.
And Colleen Kuhn and the Oscars buzz that was around it at the time. I mean, I know I've spoken to you. I think I spoke to you at the time.
You rang me the
night of the nomination.
Yeah.
And you know, the excitement around it. Has that changed anything for you? In terms of work?
Yeah, definitely. I would say definitely. I've got much more screen work since then. It's not just because I'm so wonderful. It's because... You know, because of that film, yeah.
But we were talking earlier on, I don't know if you heard the section where we were talking about the Golden Globes, and we say only two Irish nominations.
What's
just Andrew Scott and Colin Firth. But I mean, the types of the breadth of nominations that have been happening across film and television in recent years, is there a sense that a rising tide lifts all boats? Does it spread across the industry, stage and screen?
I don't know whether that's true or not. I mean, like, stage now is kind of struggling enough at the moment, I think, in this country. Whereas screen work, there's never been more screen work than there is now. Like, when you and I many years ago were doing things,
there might be stage work,
and there might have been like a film every year, you know. Yeah. Whereas now there's television shows and
so it's
movies.
It's an industry now where you work across all media.
Much more, yeah.
Large. Yeah. Well, listen, I would love to get along and hear you reading small things like these. Andrew Bennett will be doing so with live original music by Eleanor McAvoy, as he was telling us, at the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire, December the 17th and 18th, real Christmas fair. And you can find out further details on paviliontheatre.ie. Explosive is an overused word in relation to art, but it is certainly an appropriate description for a new exhibition at the Irish Museum of Modern Art. Hamad Butt uses his scientific training and artistic vision to create work that is potentially dangerous and indeed explosive, evoking ideas about death and contagion, particularly HIV/AIDS, which was very real for the artist who died an AIDS-related death in 1994 at the age of just 32. The exhibition, currently showing at IMA, is called Hamad Butt Apprehensions and is a retrospective of his work. Born in Lahore, Pakistan, and raised in London, his graduate show at Goldsmiths College, Transmission, was much lauded, and his Life Cycle of a Fly installation was even referenced by his classmate and a luminary of the young British artist movement, Damien Hirst, for his work, A Thousand Years. The IMA show opened last week, and Hamad Butt's brother, Jamal Butt, showed Keith Sheehy around the exhibition, beginning with that graduate show work, Transmission.
Well, this is really exciting for me because actually this is the first time that we have reproduced the Transmission piece, the Transmission Fly piece that Hamad had in his original end of year show at Goldsmiths in 1990. And this was an integral part of it, which is a life cycle of a fly, talking about life and death and the importance of, I guess in a way, blind faith. Because actually the concept is that the sugared paper that you've got these as Hammond described it, elliptical sentences on, the flies would be born and transmitted into flies, and then they would eat the larva, the sugared paper, and then they would die. And almost the words on the pieces of paper would then become invisible.
To me, Jamal, it looks like an old-fashioned notice board with a wooden door, glass-fronted with wooden surround. And then there are these three sheets of paper in behind each door. And that's the sugared paper.
That's absolutely correct. And for me, this is almost like something you'd find in an old school, an old grammar school somewhere on the board, and where it'd be an institution of learning, and almost the concept of the more you learn, what are you really learning about? So this particular piece, it showed it in his final year show, and it was quite disappointing that a few months later, that concept of a life cycle of a fly, sugared paper, pupa larvae had been replicated by another artist in another show a few months later.
This is Damon Hirst,
yeah,
who was a colleague of his.
They were friends and colleagues at Goldsmiths in the 1990s, and were a group of peers, part of the YBA community that constantly exchanged ideas and thoughts. Actually, after it was displayed by Damon Hirst from the Life Cycle of Fly, Hammer destroyed it. And that was really disappointing, was really angry at the time. And in subsequent shows, we just presented the transmission piece without this. So this is the first time in 30 years since 1990 that this has been reproduced. I'm really excited and delighted that Imma have decided to do that.
And this was his work, his graduate work.
This was his graduation show in 1990 at Goldsmiths. The fly piece was one part of it, and we'll move on to the glass books in a moment. And you're absolutely correct. This was his final year show that he presented.
So am I right in saying here at the centre we have, are they down here, and they're going to grow into these flies, ordinary flies?
That's exactly how it happens. Larva will pupa into flies. The flies will eat the sugar paper and then die, and then the life cycle will continue.
And one of the flies here is now crawling over one of the sentences that you talk about on these notices. We have the blindness of fear and the books of fear.
Yeah, you're right. And you can actually see this fly. We have the danger of blind faith, that the fly is actually eating the word danger as we speak, which is exactly what Hammond would have laughed at if he'd been here watching this.
So obviously this connects to his thoughts and his struggles with the ideas of faith that you say are in other aspects of the transmission exhibition.
No, absolutely. If we move on to the other parts of his final year show. So what we have here is a circular, 9 books in a circular formation, and each page contains 9 glass pages. And there's a trifid formation in each of the pages, which appears and disappears as you look through. And this was all about Hammond thinking about actually trying to elicit a sense of fear. And the closer you get to these books, there's a fluorescent light, which actually, and this is protective goggles. If you don't wear the protective goggles, the closer you get to the light, the more likely you are to get blind. So this can blind you.
So you could go in there, get the goggles, and start getting nearer and nearer to these glass books.
You could if you were in 1990. In the year of 2024, with health and safety, you can no longer do that. So actually, I remember in the Milch Gallery in 92, and his final year exhibition show, that's exactly what we do. We were moving in and out of the piece, picking up the goggles and looking at them. But I guess with modern health and safety, we can only watch from afar. But the principle is these books have no words on them. And it was also, talking to the point of blind faith. What do we believe in? One, what does religion really mean to you?
And this again relates to if you would have been brought up in a Muslim family, and then brought to England. Were you strict Muslims? Was Hammond a strict Muslim? And did those ideas make him start thinking about religion, or was it a wider interest in religion?
Yeah, my parents were very... religion was very important to them and to the whole family. And the practices and principles of Islam are a central core to how the family operates and how the family behaves. And it was important to Hammond also. Religion was important to him. How he then interacted and perceived his religion in later years, only he can tell you, is what I would say.
There's science everywhere here. There's technology in this, in the glass books. There's biology, I guess, in the fly piece. And you were a scientist, and he was a scientist.
That's absolutely correct. I'm a pharmacist by profession, so I spent a lot of my life learning about science. And Hamed also was really probably the first artist ever to really make the connection between art and science in his work. And he, as I said, before he did an art degree, he was interested in science and studied chemistry and biochemistry. And then moved into the art world. And you can see a lot of his concepts and thoughts were around, how do we display these in my work and in the work that I do? And when we move on to familiars, well, it becomes a lot more present, a lot more articulate, and the connection between art and science when we move into the familiars world becomes a lot more obvious. And we can talk about that when we get there. I think what we're in a room now where we've got, I guess, what was Hammer's most iconic piece of installation called Familiars. Which contains a series of sculptures with halogen gases, all very dangerous, but all with a different aspect to the work. So we have in front of us the cradle piece, which is a series of chlorine glass balls. Now, chlorine, as we know, is a very dangerous gas. And this piece here is in the shape of a Newton cradle. It almost invites you to swing the Newton's cradle, which normally is metal balls, and it's about you hit one ball and it moves across.
Like an executive has on his
desk.
That's
what a Newton ball is exactly, and the pendulum swings between the thing, and it's not only is it, I guess, a meditative activity, but it shows about the transfer of power through an object. That's what it's for, and it's invites you.
So
to
he's
do
got
that.
These deadly tubes. Of poison.
Yeah, it's like a corporate toy, yeah, but if you decide to use this corporate toy, you'll die. Clearly, art, you know, has art and health and safety has a place. And so this did take a number of, steps to get the work displayed, not only at the Tate in 1995 at the Rites of Passage show, but also here. I think there's an 80-page health and safety document to make sure that the works are safe to display. And the reason it's called Familiars is because this is about, that's another play on familiars, which is about dangerous spirits that live within, you know, within witchcraft and alchemy. And he was really interested in the connection between, alchemy and science and art. Hammond was a very, very deep, interesting character. And whilst he reflected carefully on his own condition and his own HIV diagnosis, which I found out during his creation of the Familiars piece, he didn't want that to define or depict his work. His work was much broader than that, much wider than that. It was about how art is depicted in the end of the 20th century, but more importantly, it was about how people thought about their own life and their own death. Clearly, there was a contagion going around at that time, which was difficult to contain, and he wanted to talk about that. He was really interested in chemistry concepts and trying to display them. In fact, this one is about contains iodine vapors in a glass ladder, and clearly, if you were to climb this ladder, it would break because they're made of glass, and there's a good chance that will.
So it's a metal ladder to the sky, which is fantastic in these new galleries in Emma, because we are actually looking up at the sky.
Yeah, I think that's exactly how he would have wanted to exhibit this piece of work. It's almost like a stairway to heaven, but actually, if you climb it, you're likely to instantly die, because not only do you release the chemicals, but this particular piece of work is quite an interesting one because it took him maybe a year and a half to 2 years to work out how to do this. It looks very simple in the way that it's being presented here, but
it's the rungs of the ladder are the things that can kill you.
Yeah, the rungs of the ladder contain iodine, and there's a metal filament, an electrical filament that lights up and heats up iodine to a set temperature in order for the iodine to sublime. Now, some chemicals go from three states of matter, liquid, solid, and gas. Iodine is one of those that goes from solid to vapor. So there's no liquid phase. And he wanted to exhibit that in his artwork. To do that, you'd have to have a set temperature with a set amount of iodine and a set volume of air. And it actually took 2 years work with Imperial College Dr. Gary Rumbold to try and work out how to do this. And actually, it took them, mathematical formulae, engineering, a whole series of activities. And when it was finally created, it actually was a final year question for the engineering degree at Imperial. So just to show the kind of thought and process intensity to produce a work of this nature.
Oh, and the rungs light up as we go along.
Yeah, yeah. It's a sequence ladder. So actually, the filaments light up on each rung as it goes up the ladder, and then the vapor then is being created, and it leaves behind, as you can see, a kind of purplish iodine vapor, which then is sublimed into gas, and then as the filament goes away, it then solidifies back to solid. And so the later ones will be less purple than the ones above it. So it's actually creating a sublimation explosion in the bulb as it's lit up.
Yeah, and it's called substance and sublimation, is
substance,
it?
Sublimation unit, absolutely correct.
There's a video in this exhibition, Jamal, which is you interviewing your brother.
No, absolutely. I was really delighted to just ask Hammond a few questions in my family home in Ilford, just about his work, his journey, and then about the future, what he was doing. It was unfortunately a few months before he passed away. But as you can, you know, the video shows a clear person articulating what the art world meant to him. He was always a hopeful character, irrespective of his condition and the situation. He was always talking about what he was going to do next. He'd produced some work, and he was talking about things that he wanted to do in the future. I know that he was really interested in the concept of holograms and holographic activity. No doubt he would have done some of that. He talks about his work being a collection of artifacts, and I know that he was interested in film, and he was also interested in writing and potentially putting a book together.
Jamal Butt there, brother of the later artist Hammad Butt, whose posthumous exhibition Apprehensions is on at the Irish Museum of Modern Art. It runs through until May of next year. Full details on imma.ie. Now to our competition. Earlier this evening I played this piece of music. Oh yes, and you were all very quick off the mark to 51551 identifying that as Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. And we played that because on the 25th of January the RTÉ Concert Orchestra will be playing Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6, the Pathétique, along with Max Brooks' wonderful violin concerto with the young soloist Roseanne Philippens, who will be speaking to us early in the new year. I am delighted to say she will be the soloist in that particular performance. But we wanted to know the Swan Lake answer for Tchaikovsky's ballet, and the winner of our competition this evening, who will be heading to that concert, as well as having the overnight stay at the 4-star Trinity Hotel in Dublin City, is Liz Davies from Dublin. Congratulations to you, Liz. Enjoy your night out on the 25th of January. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Paula Shields researched, Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, James Feeney was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again here on RTÉ Radio 1, 7 o'clock, when I will, among other things, have Damien Dempsey performing live in studio. That's tomorrow night. John Creedon, however, will be with you after the news.